Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
The new book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi, is the first detailed account of that night, 1 year ago. Internationally recognized security and terrorism experts Fred Burton and Samuel Katz look through the confusion and political spin to reveal exactly what happened in the new book. Based on insight and knowledge within the intelligence, diplomatic, and military communities in the United States and beyond, including sources on the ground in Benghazi, Burton and Katz reveal how Stevens, his diplomatic security service contingent, the CIA operatives, and other security specialists were outmanned and outgunned on that night, 1 year ago of 9/11/2012. We begin our conversation with Samuel Katz, who talks about the lack of security for the diplomatic security service.
In dealing with the realities of work in critical threat posts, especially inside the tumult and violence of the Arab Spring, the diplomatic security service has traditionally never received its due attention or understanding from the powers that be. And after Benghazi, the attention hasn't been focused enough on making sure that these brave young men and women who venture to provide security at diplomatic posts around the world have the tools, the resources, and the manpower to do what they need to do.
When you look at that night a year ago, give us a sense of what was happening and even how much concern there was about something happening, perhaps not just in that embassy, but worldwide.
I think there was sheer panic on the part of the agents initially when this started to unfold, because there was no indications that an attack was in preparation. But let's be clear here, Joe, that once the first round was fired, the agents that were there understood fully they were under a terrorist attack and relayed that to the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, who conversely also passed that back to the State Operations Center in Washington, D.C. So early on, everybody engaged in the DS infrastructure and the State Department Operations Center knew that there had been a terrorist attack in Benghazi.
And as far as Ambassador Stevens' whereabouts and his knowledge at that particular time?
Well, the ambassador scheduled a trip to Benghazi to be in the city for much of the week in question. The nature of his business is not completely known. Certain elements of his itinerary were found in pages that were discovered in the rubble and the charred aftermath of the attack. But he was the personal representative of the United States in Libya. He was serving his function, and the meetings were of the nature that it required his presence, and the agents that were responsible for security were doing their jobs when they followed him to protect him inside the city and inside the compound. The nature of the business is that ambassadors press flesh, they meet people, they go to meetings, sometimes for very open diplomatic reasons, and sometimes for missions in support of our military and our intelligence services.
You write about in the book the planning of the attack. Talk a little bit about what you were able to unearth about how this attack was planned, recruited for, ultimately promoted, and even with the use of social media.
The attack was certainly well choreographed, and clearly in our assessment there had been some pre-operational surveillance undertaken by elements associated with al-Qaeda to put together this well-thought-out kind of event. And it's the nature of that kind of attack is one that I've seen historically in some of the courses of my investigations over the course of years in looking at embassy attacks. This was not a ragtag group of individuals that decided on this given night to seize the embassy and set it on fire. Regarding the true mission, once they got onto the compound, everything is speculative even today as to what the terrorists' plans were ultimately directed towards. For example, did they intend to kidnap Ambassador Stevens and hold him hostage for a while? Did they go there with a specific intent to assassinate Ambassador Stevens? Or was the ultimate goal, the brass ring, so to speak, was to attack the nest of spies, the CIA annex, that ultimately was mortared and resulted in the death of the two former U.S. Navy SEALs and seriously injured one of the Diplomatic Security Service agents at that time. What Sam and I tried to do, we wanted to stay away from the politics that have overtaken this event and drill down into just the sheer panic and courage of the agents that were under fire that night and their efforts to try to do the best they can on any given time to try to rescue Ambassador Stevens.
Sam, I guess that brings up the question of one you address in the book, too, of why we were there in the first place. Many other international agencies had bugged out, including Great Britain. Why were we there?
In the book, we refer to a story as told by, at the time, a young Diplomatic Security Service agent who was in Beirut during the Civil War. And when he assessed that the security situation around the embassy was untenable, he cabled back to Washington and said, we have to pull out. The city isn't safe. And Washington cabled back that the U.S. presence in Lebanon at the time was for a higher purpose. So there probably was a higher purpose, a strategic interest, a diplomatic interest, an intelligence interest that warranted that the U.S. maintain its presence in country and in the city. Clearly, the U.S. government had specific interests in Libya. They had specific strategic interests in North Africa, and it was decided that a presence somehow, diplomatic and intelligence, was warranted in Benghazi. Benghazi was known throughout the country as the most volatile city in Libya following the revolution, and in many cases, even during the revolution and before, it was a volatile city. The eastern stretch of the country was always known to be more fundamentalist. It was a port city, and it was a trading post where humans and tools and material routinely passed in between Europe and elsewhere, and elsewhere in the Middle East and the African continent.
Fred, you write in the book about how only five State Department Diplomatic Security Service agents were assigned this temporary duty to protect that post, to protect that facility, as well as Ambassador Stevens. These were all young people who were volunteers.
Yes, in many ways, that's the nature of the service. I can speak firsthand to that. As a young agent within the Diplomatic Security Service, you're pretty much at the mercy of wherever Washington wants to send you. There's a famous phrase inside the hallways of Foggy Bottom is basically you work with the needs of the Foreign Service. So if you need 20 agents in Hawaii today to protect the Dalai Lama, or you need five agents in Benghazi to protect Ambassador Stevens, you are kind of moved around by these folks behind the green curtain, kind of like in The Wizard of Oz in Washington, that just makes placements based on protection details. That's one of the issues that we discuss in Under Fire, Sam and I, when we talk about some of the training. DS trains their persons very well. In fact, you learn how to drive extraordinarily well under very stressful circumstances. There's crash and bang courses, which literally we have a whole section in the book on this unbelievable agent that drove his fellow colleagues out of harm's way from the compound that night. And a lot to do with saving the lives of his colleagues was based upon the training. So we try to talk about that. But at the end of the day, much like our military all around the world, you have very young agents in many places on any given day that have to do the best they can under very difficult and trying circumstances.
The first calls by State Department security agents to the White House, they labeled it as a terrorist assault, correct?
Well, the agents in Benghazi followed protocol and procedure, and they contacted the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli. and they also contacted the CIA annex in Benghazi. And then, like anything in government, the bureaucracy took its course. There are levels of command, and you go up the ladder. And ultimately, of course, word reached the Secretary of State and the White House. But the agents didn't pick up the phone and call the Secretary of State. And during this time, there was a lot of effort to gather intelligence. But there was something known as the fog of terror, when you don't really know what's happening on the ground. You're disseminating voices over radios. Sometimes the voices are panic-strewn. There's gunfire in the background, and you're trying to create an assessment that's accurate, because that assessment and the accuracy of the reporting that is being given will be able to best direct resources that will be forwarded for any rescue or withdrawal.
When you look at what happened and ultimately how it unfolded for us in this country, of what we learned, of how we learned it, of the confusion, I'm just interested of if you can juxtapose those two scenarios for us, of the confusion here versus the confusion there, and how much of what was known there was actually coming through truthfully here.
Well, that's one of the misconceptions, I think, that a lot of people have based upon the politics that have surrounded this case. The counterterrorism community is not geared for cabinet-level officials or even the president to make a decision on a split second. We all can remember the infamous pictures of President Obama in the Situational Room when they're going to get bin Laden. Well, that's something that is pre-planned. That's something that everybody's assembled for, and provides great photo opportunities. But when you have fast-breaking events such as this unfold, the system is really geared down to a very basic level, and literally special agents are stuck with making the tactical decisions on the ground. Information's conveyed back into a tactical operations center in Washington, and it's emailed all around Washington. And so by the time it works its way up to any given chain, information moves very quickly. I don't think there's anybody that we talk to that denied knowing that this wasn't a terrorist attack that night. I have no explanation for why the discussions and the talking points came out other than politics that followed on. But it was quite clear during the events in Benghazi that the special mission was under terrorist attack that night.
So right now, a year later, Sam, do you see things in place that could prevent an attack like this of happening again? Did we learn a lesson?
The question of if we have learned our lesson will only be answered the next time there is an attack, and if the people involved in security are successful in repelling the attack. The traditional response to anything is always to throw more money at it and to try and fix everything with gadgets and walls, items that prevent access and any sort of means by which a terrorist can strike. But the reality is that the U.S. must operate in that world. The U.S. must have a presence. So the lessons, you know, it's a very difficult question to answer, because the attack in Benghazi has certainly put a lot of attention on lightly guarded posts or posts that are on waivers or do not meet certain standards. But to implement security protocols in those posts takes a lot of time, a lot of money. And you never know when the terrorists are going to strike and if all those protocols will be established and in place.
The name of the book is Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. It is by Fred Burton and Samuel Katz. Fred and Samuel, I thank you very much for taking the time out this morning, and I appreciate you sharing with us.
Thank you, Joe, for having us on. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Under Fire, The Untold Story of the Attack in Benghazi. It is published by St. Martin's Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.